directing the 2000 International Rose Festival, which begins in Adelaide on October 19. I think this is a fabulous initiative to have this Rose Festival. There would be barely a person in this room, probably apart from Ian Dobler, who hasn't got a rose of some sort in their garden. And what I like about this Rose Festival in October is that I don't believe Sydney or Brisbane or even Melbourne can pinch it from us, because you can't grow decent roses in subtropical weather, Sydney and Brisbane particularly, and Melbourne's weather is so fickle that they can't grow decent roses. In fact, South Australia grows 50% of all roses produced in Australia. We've got the right soil, the right climate, and I think the right size and the right atmosphere to have a festival of this sort. I think South Australia is also very lucky that Adrian Greenoak, what a splendid name for a man in horticulture, Adrian Greenoak, isn't it lovely, has agreed to be our first director. Adrian has been, or still is, I'm not sure, the director of the Hampton Court Palace Flower Show, which in his turn as director has developed into probably the biggest general gardening show in the world. And I think that's what we've got to look for here, that under Adrian's early guidance, that we can develop this into one of the really great gardening shows of the world. But Adrian's got far more skills than that. He is a musician of great skill. He plays the piano, the oboe, I understand the flute, and I'm sure if we brought in a 16-string sitar, he could play that as well. He's produced his own scripts, been in BBC television productions, and I find also that his cultural skills extend to being an official wine taster, and there's been a bit of a struggle on the table to get your hands on the gramps today. In fact, if we'd left it any longer, there may have been no guest speaker. And now I'm introducing him, I might say, too. Adrian once said, "I never play music for money. Sometimes I might play for my supper, and I only play my own music." Adrian's here today to sing for his lunch, at least. Adrian Greenoak.
Mr. President, Acting President, members of the press club and guests, I'm delighted to be here this afternoon to talk to you about the 2000 International Rose Festival, Adelaide, and hopefully to share with you a few thoughts and reflections pertaining to my experience so far here in Adelaide and in Australia. Just to give you a little background of the event, it really goes back some time, back to the early 90s, in fact, when I received a call from the Agent General's office in London. I was the director at the time, as Rex said, of the Hampton Court Palace Flower Show, and the simple question was, we're thinking of holding an international event in Adelaide, would you be interested in coming to the city and having a look for us to see if there was such a potential? After some time I was delighted to accept the invitation. I arrived here in 1995, and there were a number of things that struck me almost immediately about the city. It was an interesting way to be introduced to the city. I think I arrived about 5:30 in the morning, and the only place open was McDonald's down at the bottom of Hindley Street. But the advantage was, of course, that it's mostly glass. The windows there are pretty well take up the whole wall space. And I was deeply affected by the quality of light that exists here in Adelaide. The only thing like it I've ever met has been near the North Pole. There's a certain clarity here which really does sparkle. And you might say that's a rather odd quality to note, but any of you who have been in the horticultural business or have been to other climes, especially northern climates, where there's a tremendous amount of cloud, certainly when I used to grow plants in England, one of my greatest desires was to increase the light intensity. And friends of mine from Australia used to come to England on its brightest, clearest days and say to me, Adam, when is the mist going to clear? And I would always say, well, it's not. This is what we call blue. And I really didn't understand until I came here, and particularly to Adelaide, because there is, I think, something exceptional about the light quality here. And it is no surprise to me, and was no surprise to me, as I went with various members of the horticultural industry to find that the rose really was a highlight of that industry. Some of the roses here I didn't recognise, simply because the blooms seem to be a great deal larger, and of course much of the foliage was a beautiful dark green, and it then became clear to me that the possibilities of a first class event were certainly possible. It was interesting that from that point there were many inquiries from the horticultural industry saying, you know, what could happen and how could it happen? And there are many people, as often is the case with new events, many, many different people from diverse backgrounds were involved in those early days in trying to see what actually could happen. Eventually, it was announced in 1998 that an event would happen. It was announced by the Premier at Gardens Live in Botanic Park. And since then, there have been, again, many changes in the way the event has been put together, come together. And I'm glad to say the government have taken a huge initiative in making sure that this event happens. And it's my thanks to them, because my life has been very largely involved with the horticultural business. I have a great respect for the people in horticulture. They are an interesting breed of people, but I've always found their attitude to work, their sympathies for work and the work that they do has been a great pleasure to me, and I think it is a great wealth to any country. And so I'm delighted whenever there is the possibility of a new event, and an event which can produce, I think, something exceptional. Before I go on to the actual event, perhaps a little background on how I look at events. I see events very much as organic processes. I treat them very much like animals, beasts, and I have to make sure when I create one that I can control the beast. But much like a beast, much like an animal, someone has to have their finger on the pulse. Someone has to make sure it runs when it needs to run and walks when it needs to walk, and it doesn't get out of hand. But I very much approach the growth of an event from that perspective. Most of the people around the world who ask me to help them with events, especially if there are events which have been taking place for a while, often the problem is that they've never really thought about the growth of their event in an organic way. They seem to think that you can go around the world, pick off certain policies, a bit here from Rome, a bit here from London, a bit here from Moscow, we'll mix it all up like a cake, and then we'll have a great event and we'll throw millions of dollars at the promotion and marketing, and it's going to be a great success. After 3 years they come to me and they say, Adrian, we're throwing more dollars at the marketing and the promotion, but our sponsors are not terribly happy with the gates going down, you know, what is the problem? And often my first question to them is, what makes you think your event will grow? What is actually part of your event in terms of its raw materials and those people who are crucial to its success, what is it that will actually make your event grow? And as I say, I would say 99% of the interest inquiries that I've had have been because they simply have not addressed that issue. Here, of course, we have very, very much addressed that issue. And the way I do that in whatever country I'm in is, I think, probably best characterized by the word sound, by the word, or perhaps listening. I have no preconceived ideas of what I'm going to create. And that is a fact. When I came here, my interest was to see what the industry here does, what are the strengths of that industry, what are the weaknesses of the industry, how does it work in some countries, and I think this is, I'll talk a little more about it later, but the chemistry here, the dynamic in Australia is really very challenging and certainly very, very different from almost anything else I'm involved with. But I listened carefully to what I heard from horticulturalists. And it's not a mist. It's not. I'm not being a mystic when I say that I also listen to the ground. Having been in horticulture for many years, and those of you who are in that industry, it's very common for a person who knows about plants or grows plants, when they go into an environment, they smell the air. They smell the air. They're smelling the atmosphere, but they're also smelling the earth, and they're also smelling the plants. And although every grower, every propagator has a different way of approaching the growing of plants, it's often by that smell, which is a whole mixture of intuition, instinct and experience, which says, yes, these plants need this, they need that, or they need the other. But it is a very much an intuitive, a fed information process, which comes from the soil and what grows in it. And of course, very much part of that is are the people that one is working with. And insofar that Australia's history is largely based in what is called the good old country, it's very interesting for me to see how many of the ways and processes of Europe have changed since they've been here in Australia. So what I did, I listened, as I say, carefully to what was being said, and I then, working with some very, very capable and interested horticulturists here in Adelaide, we started the process of creating policies. And one of the things that amazed me was I was sitting in Melbourne Street one evening thinking of the real basic root of the event, and suddenly some ideas started to come to me. And the more I looked at these ideas, the more I was impressed by their simplicity. And I kept looking at these and saying to myself, now why have I never thought of these ideas before? They're just so simple. And I'm sure that is a quality that South Australia in particular, and I have visited other parts of Australia, seems to enable. It was... This system that we have developed for this event, in terms of its basic organisation, is unique. I have no idea why no one else is using it. It is so simple. Yes, I have no idea. Of course, it's not so much that people wouldn't like to use the system we're using here in Adelaide, but they can't because there are many institutions developed in various countries which simply stop those simple ideas coming through. So they never really find air. They're, as it were, like new flowers, which can only exist if the atmosphere is right. And there is no doubt, had I presented the policies that we have developed for Adelaide and presented them in London, if I had got those through the multiple committees in 7 years, I think I would have been very lucky. Whereas here, I presented them to a board, as I say, of interested people, and there was general enthusiasm, interest and excitement, and we moved to the next step in about half an hour. But that just gives you an idea of scale in terms of what is possible, I think, in Adelaide compared with some of the problems I have in other cities. In putting these policies together, it's very important to see, as I spoke earlier, of how they will develop. How will they draw through the raw material, the raw quality of a particular industry? And I'm very glad to say that the policies we've developed here have really produced some very, very exciting results. Just as I was talking of the route policies, some of the policies we've developed for the actual ingredients of the event are extremely exciting, almost impossible in many other countries because people are not receptive to the ideas. I've been visiting many growers over the last months, and each time I visit, I visit them, and they have responded very positively, very creatively to the policies of the event, which means we now have an international rose pavilion, the like of which has not been seen anywhere. It is challenging, it's diverse, and it really does involve almost all the main ingredients and main qualities of the South Australian environment, horticulturally, but I'm glad to say it has also encouraged. We have David Austin's from England coming out, and we do have, in another area of the event, one of the best growers in England also contributing. We've had a good deal of interest from abroad. But what is exciting is that there are one or two people, for example, in London who have seen the initial plans of Adelaide, and they're already asking me, Adrian, when is Adelaide going to publish what it's doing? And we will do shortly when we're ready. But I feel sure that some of the policies we've developed here will be copied. There are many event organisers that would love to be able to achieve what is going to be achieved here in Adelaide. These policies do move on to the area of judging events, and the judging of horticultural events is a very major issue in many countries and is bogged down often by many what one would call prejudices. My feeling has always been about judging, and I'm very interested in the subject, is not so much that one can ever achieve an unprejudiced human being. The important thing when judging is to know when you've got a prejudice. And the other element of judging, of course, is to make sure that whatever process or system one uses, that it is relevant to the event one creates, and it's not an attempt to be God. It's not an absolute, and it is there simply as a mechanism to bring through, excite, to stimulate conversation so that people can actually improve and give vent to the aspirations and desires that they have. It's very important for me to say this afternoon that it's not just roses. It was, I think, absolutely the right choice to make it the rose the centrepiece of the event, but such is the strength of the rose here that it's enabled us to embrace almost every other area and department of horticulture. And we're trying to do this in a way which will excite both beginners, people of all ages, and it will show them some displays and exhibits which, again, I know from my work abroad, would be accepted at the highest level. I was asked when I first came here to look at an international event, and I'm sure many of you, probably all of you, read this word international event, and there are those who say, well, how many people from Taiwan have you got? How many people from Ireland? How many from the Falkland Islands have you got? What makes it international? I have a very simple definition of what is international, and with regard to an event, it means an event which has a power, a strength, which is attractive to a very broad band of both informed and uninformed people. And I feel that this event in Adelaide does have that distinction, and there will be many people from abroad, and it's already happening, who will take great interest in what Adelaide is doing. It's a leading edge event, and I'm very proud to be part of it. Lastly, I would just like to say a little bit about some of my experiences, reflections in working here in Adelaide. I must say I have found it probably one of the most challenging countries to work in, and a lot of people in Australia, Adelaideans, have said to me, "Adrian, why? You know, why? Adelaide is, you know, little old Adelaide is the most wonderful place on earth, and what is the challenge?" And perhaps it is because there is that strange, and I do find it strange creatively, momentum, that is a collection of movements which allow me to work in completely new areas. Now that sounds sort of a big deal, but it is true, and I've often wondered about the truth of this. But when I was coming here this year, I came from Kuala Lumpur, and in Kuala Lumpur I was reading the Quran before I took the plane, which is an amazing book, wonderfully written. It was full of commentaries of the religion, and it stayed with me as I got on the plane. I was thinking through some of the thoughts and ideas of the book, and I was literally, it was dark, I was just passing over the edge of Australia, and suddenly there was no Quran, and it really was as if something else, some other presence, some other purpose was saying, not that, something else, a different. I think what this country does is, or what it potentially does, is define a new kind of freedom, and I think that is the great challenge which is before Australia, because it is challenging in itself because of the various powers that bear upon it. There are a number of people here I've met, especially in country areas, who quite obviously have a very, very pleasurable existence, but they're also fighting to make themselves not known to a community so much, but to express themselves through a community. And an event such as the 2000 International Rose Festival, Adelaide, I think, has a purpose, has an interactive, a catalytic effect on those kind of aspirations. And I think if the event can achieve that and help Adelaide, Australia, the world of horticulture to grow, then it truly does a great thing. Thank you very much.
Working. Adrian, thank you for that. You haven't quite paid for your lunch yet. We have a tradition here, which I didn't outline before because I thought you may have fled away, that we throw the guest speaker to the lions. So I specifically invite questions from the floor, and it's the tradition that the paid media get the first bite of the cherry. So anyone from the media, I please invite questions to Adrian.
As a visitor at the Hampton Palace, Hampton Court Palace last year, I'm excited to hear about what it was like to create a festival or the gardens there.
What was it like?
Experiences. I mean, you've got a place that Henry VIII lived in,
yes,
and there you are creating rose gardens. It must have been an incredible experience.
It was. It was. I think the fact was, in those days, in 1989, there was no really large event in the world apart from the Chelsea Flower Show, and Chelsea Flower Show, of course, is the mother of all shows. But the fault or the mistake that almost every organiser who had attempted a large event, the mistake they tried to compete with the Chelsea Flower Show. and those who've been to the Chelsea Flower Show, it is a social event. It's the first spring event on the royal calendar, and what we were trying to do, or I was trying to do, is create something which was not in any way competing with Chelsea. And because my life had been involved in horticulture, I knew the wealth of talent that existed in the country, but now untapped. Chelsea used really quite a narrow band of exhibitors. And when the first Hampton Court arrived, people from various institutions said to me, "Adrian, where did these people come from?" Well, the fact is they never looked. It was full of young people, young talent. And what we did was create an event which could supply that talent. And also, when in speaking with Her Majesty, we had to convince her that what we were doing was going to be a truly egalitarian event, which was what I wanted. I wanted to create something that was not a social event, but was an event for people, an event for people who could and did enjoy horticulture. As it turned out, every member of the royal family came to that event. They just came because it was egalitarian. There was no fuss. I think I was one of the only organisers of a major event that allowed a member of the royal family to go wherever they liked, and they loved it. Most of the royal family, they go when you tell them, literally. And they will go towards a brick wall. And they only look at you a little to think, you know, when are we going to stop? But what I did, and it was simply because of some of the excellent security people I had, it happened first with the Princess Royal, and she said to me, "Adrian, can I go over there?" And I'm sure she only said that because she'd already picked up the vibration, the feeling of the event that was open. We didn't have barriers everywhere. We didn't have police in uniform everywhere. I used SAS men mostly, SAS and people with ropes and who just moved around amongst the crowd. But I think she picked up the atmosphere, and I said, "Yes, you can go over there." And it was like I always remember the "Can I?" "Yes," you know, like 50 metres. But of course, the reason I wanted to invite people like that, royalty, was because the visitors loved it. And that's what I wanted. There was no other reason, as far as I was concerned, for them being there. But it was a hugely exciting event. It was a first. None of the establishment supported us. I was told I was far, far too ambitious. I wouldn't find the exhibitors, and I certainly wouldn't find the sponsorship, which was considerable. But I'm glad to say that we treated the press extremely well. We gave them such a day on the first day they arrived, and I don't think any of them ever forgot. We built them a mountain of cake, which was full of fruit, and it went to about 8 metres high, and it was absolutely spectacular. And we didn't bother them. They had a great time. But it was, because it was cutting new ground, because Hampton Court really cut new ground, that was the most exciting part. And once, of course, it happened, and then it grew and grew and grew. Since then, there has been a proliferation around the world of similar events, which I'm very, and Hampton Court still goes from strength to strength. Thank you.
Brad Crouch from the Sunday Now. Adrian, can I throw two at you? One's just a mundane workaday journalist question. Can you give us an idea of the economic benefit of the festival, the number of visitors, the increase in tourism, the dollars being churned, the type of tourists that's coming, whether they'll stay for a long time, that sort of thing? And secondly, just a personal question. We've had a lot of guests at the press club, but I've never seen one wearing white gloves. Is that to hide a green thumb or a gardening injury, or is that just part of your workaday elegance?
Well, I used to have a rabbit, but I didn't bring it with me today. I call it a creative condition. It's simply to do with, literally as I speak, my skin is burning off my fingers, and I simply wear gloves because it cools them down. With regard to your first question, we thought obviously a great deal about the economic benefits, and I have spoken about them earlier in terms of how I think the event actually works within a community. And I think there are all kinds of real Often they're not the sort of things that politicians perhaps are that interested in, but I do believe there are very real benefits to a community in the way they can get involved with an event. We are targeting 50,000 visitors to the event. We are looking already to tours and trips from abroad. We already have bookings from America and from the UK, people who will be coming to the event and staying. Because the Rose is the centrepiece, we have a direct connection with all the Rosarians around the world. And there is no doubt that the Rosarians, being what they are, if they see a highlighted event such as will be happening here, I think we're pretty well guaranteed to get a good number of Rosarians from a large number of different countries. Tours, package tours have now been put together, and they are now available in various parts of the world. Our communication system, which uses everything really which we have at our disposal at Australian Major Events, is extremely wide, and through the tourism office as well, we're able to dispense information and material to a very, very wide audience. We are hoping to attract younger people as well as older people, and we are trying to be accessible to people who are both beginners and expert in the business of horticulture. Do you want me to go on? Is that enough, or would you like some more? For the cost of the event?
Cost and benefit?
No, I can't give you that, I don't think.
No.
Yes, Mr. Greenhoek, Catherine Dunning Armstrong, Australian Consolidated Press. I noticed reading your curriculum vitae that your basic degree is in nuclear physics. And while I don't want to pun, there is a quantum leap between nuclear physics and horticulture. Would it be too intrusive to ask you how you first went into nuclear physics, and then what decided you to move from nuclear physics into horticulture?
Thank you. The simple answer is the stars. I had and still have, a passionate interest in astronomy, and it was really through astronomy that led me to mathematics and eventually to nuclear physics. And I did some work with NASA, I was part of a very large company, and I always remember the afternoon where the head of a department, scientific department, came to me and said, "We really want you to stay here, come and see the crew, come and see the youngsters like yourself who are being groomed for the various international appointments." And he took me into a room about this size. There were rows and rows of desks like a school, and suddenly a bell rang and they all got up, all picked up their briefcases and walked out. And I thought, this is not for me. This is not the place I should be. And although I've always continued my interest in the stars, of course, what interests me about the stars is their beauty, their depth of beauty. And the only thing like that really was the depth of beauty that I found in natural things. I always had a love of trees and flowers, and I wanted to do something different. So I started as an assistant gardener. I was very careful not to tell anyone what my background was, and I learned with a grower, a propagator, and eventually learned the skills and became a propagator. Then I became a nursery manager, and then had my own business for a while. I used to grow plants for the film industry, which was exciting. They used to ask me for fully blown, say, petunias in the middle of December, January, and I used to have to cook them in all kinds of interesting ways. Now, I shall never forget my nursery days, and although I was doing some film, some theatre and literary work at the same time, I think it's true to say that once horticulture, once the growing of plants, the being with gardens begins in a person, it never goes. It gets into the blood, and once it's there, it's one of the most rewarding impulses and pleasures I think there is on earth. Thank you.
Yeah, David from Sunday Mail, Adrian. The parents of victims of one of the canning disaster in Switzerland have just commissioned a new rose for their daughter as a memorial, an everlasting memorial presumably, and they're using it to set up a trust to raise money, and also, as I said, as a memorial to their daughter. Can you tell us how much it would cost other people to set up something similar, and also why is it the rose? What is the evocative feel that the rose promotes in the world? I mean, its song, everything else.
Thank you. With regard to an individual, for example myself, if I wish to have a rose named after a loved one, there are a huge number of different routes that one can take. Just to give you an idea, I have done this with a group of people who wanted a rose, and I think the end cost to them was in sterling was about £25,000. But and it is quite complicated. You're dealing with all kinds of different rights and royalties, and of course, as in the case you mentioned, often these are set up and the royalties go to a designated charity. I think the last time I was involved with this process was some years ago, and I do think they have now improved it. They've improved the process, but unfortunately there is still quite a lot of problem in terms of the actual naming of plants. The most difficult thing is you find a plant you like, a rose that you like, but then you've got to make sure that it is, or see how that rose is perhaps known already within the industry, and there is a lot of renaming that goes on. So people will take an already named rose and give it a new name, and you can imagine the kind of confusion that does exist. So it is something that one would not enter lightly. It is thought with problems, and it can be got through, and I think it's a great idea, and of course a lot of charities now do it with great efficiency. Your second question is obviously an extremely interesting one. I know that certainly at Hampton Court, when we did some research to find which was the most popular element of the event, it was almost always the Rose Pavilion. Roses seem to have existed in our culture, in human culture, for many, many years. I live on the island of Crete, and it was on a wall in Knossos, near Heraklion, where it is thought that the first rose was actually painted. But certainly in the Mediterranean, there's a huge pleasure in roses. The East, of course, loved their roses. The Romans used roses for almost everything. They ate it, used it as perfume, used it for beds. And what is it about it? It's very difficult to say. It does have a particular beauty. I love the single roses myself. But there is something in its nature, perhaps a mingling of colour, tenacity, contradiction, which simply lends itself to the same within the human condition. And perhaps that's a part of the mystery.
I'm Andrew from the Advertiser. Will you be using young people as exhibitors here in Adelaide like you did in Hampton Court? And what's your strategy, of trying to attract the young crowds here at our festival?
To answer the latter part first, what we are doing is try to move the concept of a flower show more towards performance, because that's what it is. I treat a horticultural event very much like theatre. The difference is that the actors and actresses are plants and the people involved with them in some way. And as you probably see or note from the media promotion, we've come right away from the baskets of flowers, the watering cans. We're looking at something a little more exciting. There will be performance at this event. We're looking at really good high quality music. We're looking at good quality food. We're looking at an entertainment, and we hope a day's entertainment where there will be, apart from plants, the colour, there will also be an inspirational element. And there's a tremendous amount within the world of horticulture and its related disciplines which I think can and do now attract more and more young people. So we're trying to do it both through the through our media campaign. We are talking to various colleges, schools, institutes, and we are now developing some quite exciting ideas which will relate to schools, we hope.
Starting to run out of time, but Bob Maine's got a question. We'll take
just a quick one, Adrian. As the owner of 350 rose bushes, I don't suppose you'd like to come down and help me prune them, will you? Well, seriously, why do roses have thorns? And second question, could you give us a minute or two on the peace rose? Probably there's quite a few people here who don't know about it, and where it is now.
To answer your first question, who knows why a plant has the particular characteristic of thorn. Of course, there are many plants that do have thorns, and I think perhaps it is that natural state of contradiction which exists in nature, which bears itself in so many different examples, both in the plant world and in the animal world. It's a very, very interesting question. I don't think anyone scientifically has properly answered it. And of course there are now thornless plants and certainly thornless roses.
Well, Winnicott, formerly ABC. I was also intrigued by your... thank you, Adrian Greenock, for the most excellent talk, by the way. But I was also intrigued by wearing your white gloves. The question has already been answered, but I thought perhaps on the subject of thorns that, like Rex Jory, you had thorns in your fingers. Thank you for your talk.
Thank you.
Somewhere there,
Wayne from Professional Public Relations. Following on from Brad Crouch's question, the industry has always been involved with constantly developing new varieties, and traditionally by crossing one variety with another and letting nature take its course. Well, now we live in an age of genetic modification. What is the attitude of the rose industry towards GM?
I think within the industry as a whole, it is quite quite mixed. The traditions of breeding of roses, of course, in many countries, and especially France and England, are very, very deep indeed. In other countries, for example, in Australia, where the breeding is really at an infancy, but I think there is great potential. And I think it's probably here, and certainly, obviously, in America, where some of these techniques will be developed. I think it is characteristic of the horticulture industry that they tend not to be too articulate publicly about some of these sort of issues. They tend to very much go their own way. If they find something and it works, certainly when the treatment of plants involving various hormones was introduced to many nurseries, although embraced in an experimental way for some years, many nurseries I knew soon rejected it, simply on the grounds that it seemed unnatural to them. And I think there is a strong sense among the people who work with plants which if something happens which seems to them to go against the grain of the growing principles, they tend not to give it huge consideration despite the possible returns financially.
Adrian, I think that's it for today, but I know there's some rose fanciers down the back who are going to grab you before you leave and ask the technical questions that Ian Dover and others in the media have no idea about.
Someone down here had a problem with black spot on their yes. leaf, which seemed beyond my comprehension. I would like to say on behalf of everyone here, thank you for what you said. I found it stimulating because you talked about things in terms of life being a flat race, whereas I think in South Australia we sometimes think it's a hurdle race. You talked about new ideas, you talked about fresh ideas, you complimented us as if, and perhaps we are in your eyes, as if we're young and we're growing, we've got something new to offer, everything from the bright light to the energy of our community. And I think if you can bring that out in this exhibition or display or whatever we're going to call it, I think we can look forward to something quite special. I liked also the way that you said that you hoped it would grow, perhaps because of community change and community pressure, rather than some authoritarian group at the top telling it how to grow. And I think that we picked the right man for the job, and what you said today, you really tantalised us because you didn't give us quite enough of the detail and where we can go and what we can expect to see. And I think that certainly everyone here, and I hope people not only from Adelaide and Australia but overseas, will come to see what you create. So thank you very much on behalf of everyone here for an insight into what you propose on October 19th. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Before you go, you describe the festival you're creating as a beast which grows. We've got two beasts in this box of Jacob's Creek limited edition. Handle them with care because they will grow too, and it's perhaps a small memento of today and the value we see in the job you're doing. Thank you very much indeed.